ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Damien Carrick with you. This is The Law Report. When refugees arrive in Australia, they face huge challenges. So how do they access the support they need? Perhaps counterintuitively, a newly launched children's book is designed to help refugees get legal help. It's a very simple, beautifully illustrated book titled The Ribbon, and it's available in English, Dari, Burmese, Swahili, and Arabic.
When my room is dark and my busy brain won't let me sleep, my ribbon falls into an itsy knot.
That's Nahara Odishu, Community Engagement Officer with the New South Wales Legal Aid Refugee Service, which commissioned the ribbon.
We are not alone with the heavy knots we feel. There are special hands that can try to untie them.
There's this lovely image of a ribbon which kind of surrounds and goes through the family, and in happy situations the ribbon is loose and floating around, and in stressful situations it tightens into a knot. Those stressful situations include a sort of a pile of letters on a table, which might be about, debts which are mounting up, or, you know, confusing interactions with bureaucracy. And also when parents start fighting, the knot also appears. So you say at the end of the book, there is somebody who can help you with these problems. And there's a kind of an image, I guess, of a legal aid office.
Legal aid office.
I'm wondering, Nahara, can you read me a few lines from the book to help people get a flavour of the book?
I'll read the book in English and follow the Arabic. May Billy has a ribbon wiggling inside. Stretch, dances, curves and ties. في بطن شريط يتلوى يتمدد يرقص يتجعد ويشكل عقدة. It can make a loop as small as a pea. It can make a knot as big as the moon. يمكن أن يشكل حلقة صغيرة مثل حبة البازلاء ويمكن أن يصنع عقدة كبيرة مثل القمر. I feel the ribbons tight when the people we love are kept far away. أشعر بشرائطهم تشتد وتضيق عندما الناس الذين نحب أبقوا بعيدا عنا. I hear the ribbons tremble when they move to touch with the hands that hurt. أسمع شرائطهم ترتعش عندما أيديهم تؤذي من تلمسه.
And what's the message that you're trying to communicate with this book?
The message is it's targeted for newly arrival clients and communities who have arrived on refugees and humanitarian visas when they try to navigate and build a new life in Australia, whether from language barriers, cultural differences, or complex legal system that we even find hard to navigate, that there is this service that can help them with all those daily legal issues that they don't know they are legal issues, and they can ask for a free service and free legal advice.
So why is it so difficult to let people know about that free legal advice? Lynn Payne is Senior Solicitor with the New South Wales Legal Aid Refugee Service.
Well, I think the major obstacle is sort of the first obstacle, and that is when they first arrive, people are inundated with information about our service, but also about the services that they really need to engage with, places like Centrelink, banks and schools to, you know, educate their children. And so I think the first challenge is that there's just so much information that people have to absorb. And they're already coming from a place of trauma and dislocation, so it's incredibly difficult for them to do all of that at once. And I think that that's part of the settlement process, is giving information to people because we think that's what they need. And indeed, they do need that. But it's the way that we convey that information and also the timing of it. And so they're the things that we in the Refugee Service really alive to. And part of that is just because we've all worked in this area for a very long time. But mostly it's because we have Nahara's incredible insights about what it's like to come as a refugee and deal with this plethora of information that can be overwhelming. I think another issue that, we're very conscious of is that it's not enough simply to create a resource in language, you know, create a resource that, say, might be in English, and then simply translate it and expect that that will be received by the community. There are many reasons why that simply is not the right way to reach a community. One of the major ones is that for many of our clients, they're not literate in their own language. Even if we do translate things into language, it's still not accessible to them. We've tried to get around that in various ways. One way that we do things is that we create videos that are in language.
أخذت ماسك تغيرك برابا أرخاتي لا أخشي نأخذ نتلوخ خطرة عن بوليسي.
We've got a series of them on housing, for instance, in a number of community languages. So people can just, they're on YouTube, you can just watch them on your phone. And so we don't expect people to read the resource, it's just there available to them. This book, I think, is another illustration of how we've tried to communicate with a particular cohort of refugees, and that is women with young children.
Okay, so you're trying to tap into to women, and the focus is, you know, it's about all your legal needs, but it is also addressing domestic violence. Nahara Odishu, you have pamphlets, presumably, which address issues around domestic violence. Do those pamphlets get picked up when you're at a community event? I mean, what are some of the obstacles to women in this situation accessing the information which is already there, and why is this book a different way of getting the message out there?
I've noticed during any community events and public places and outreach sessions that women, especially when they have children under 5 years old, they're not connected to any services, they don't go to English classes, they're just isolated. And so they would come to those events in a park and pushing pram with kids on full hands, and they would have looked at all different resources, and they would take any flyers about domestic violence or family issues, separation. They would read it, even if they translated versions, and they just put it back. And with all the trainings that we received about domestic violence and culturally diverse backgrounds, communities, there's the whole stigma about domestic violence in the communities, and being like the good wife and accepting everything happen, good partner, accepting everything happen in the family, not sharing with anyone. It's taking a flyer or brochure about some issues happening in the family that could put those partners at risk, well, with their partners, with their husbands, so they wouldn't take them. They wouldn't talk about domestic violence issues happening or family issues happening. That's why this resource came as something, as a safe, easy, colorful resource in language, in client's language, that they only need the numbers in the bag to contact the service and ask for appointment, or even if they're not sure if they have legal issue.
So you're saying that, you know, a pamphlet with a big kind of bold heading saying this is where you can go if you're experiencing domestic violence, that ain't going to work with these communities for a whole range of reasons, including that, you know, you might put yourself at risk if you take that home. But also sort of language issues as well and cultural issues. So this is a way of subtly introducing that we understand that there are issues out there and there is somewhere where you can go for help. Can I ask, how are you getting this out to people? Are you sort of handing it to people? I mean, where are you distributing this book? Where are people accessing this book?
So I have been taking this resource with me to all different community events, and it's the first thing that ran out on any table, any stall. They would take it because it's like, it looks beautiful and it's easy to follow with all those images.
And I believe a lot of refugee people will go to sort of play groups and community hubs and meetings at settlement services.
Exactly, yeah, and library, yeah.
So the book is available there and you know, you can give it to people and use it as a way, as a starting point for a conversation, right?
Yeah, and it's a book you would, it's an activity book. You read the book with the family, with the children, and then we start talking with the family, with the mothers, like, what do they think about the book? Does this resonate with them, with all different legal issues that's, yeah, that have been mentioned in the book?
Mm. Can I ask about people who've arrived as refugees? I mean, obviously, they're coming from a situation of often year after year of many years of trauma and a total distrust of authority. Both you might have personal distrust of authority and you don't know how authorities are going to react if you come forward with a problem about another family member, say your spouse. So there are a lot of obstacles and a lot of reasons why people don't want to come forward.
Yes, exactly. And it's so much misinformation about the laws in Australia, especially with the clients arriving on refugee and humanitarian visa. They are permanent residents, so there's no risk on their visas. And also the lack of knowledge about the family law and their rights with the parenting. Most of the families and mothers, they would think if they report that to police, that the father or the police will remove the child from their care. So it's all this misinformation happening around. And also about knowing about the legal system and like the legal support. And they would think if they go to lawyer or ask for a question, they have to pay so much money. And most of them, they don't have that capacity. Yeah.
Now, I understand, Nahara Adishu, you come from an Assyrian background, and I think you arrived in Australia about 10 years ago as a refugee. Were these challenges that you saw in your community at that time?
Yes, actually I arrived in 2015, so just a little bit less than 10 years. Yeah, that's one of the challenges I noticed in the community was the first thing that don't get in trouble with law. Lawyers cost so much money, just stay away from trouble. Even if you want to ask for your rights, just like be quiet in a way. I came with my dad, we then came with the whole family. So my brothers, they were still overseas and just the idea of asking lawyer how to bring my family, my brothers, he's Australia. It took us like 6 months just to get an appointment because we weren't sure about the process, where to go and to ask for help. Yeah.
Lynn Payne, let me bring you in here. Yes. The Refugee Legal Service from New South Wales Legal Aid, you act for people who are, if you like, recognised refugees and have arrived here on humanitarian visas, as opposed to asylum seekers seeking to obtain a visa here. Now, Nahara just mentioned about family reunion. I understand that's one of the biggest issues that your legal service, one of the biggest needs that your legal service deals with. Tell me about that work.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the things that we see people presenting with almost immediately upon arrival is they want to bring their family. So they've left family behind. Sometimes immediate family, so wives or husbands and children, sometimes extended family, brothers and sisters and parents. But their immediate concern, once they are here and safe, is they want to bring their family with them. So that is probably about 60% of the clients that we see first up present with that problem. A year later or 6 months later, they'll come back to us, and they always come back to the same lawyer with, say, a housing issue. And then a year after that, a Centrelink issue or a car issue. We are able to build the trust of our clients because we're consistent, we're always there, and we're always responsive to the things that they need in the way that they need us to be responsive.
And Nahara Adishu, what was it like when you first saw a lawyer, you and your family first saw a lawyer here in Australia? What was it? Were you trepidatious or concerned?
I think I didn't understand the concept of free lawyer. Like, I thought there would be some fees later, or I wouldn't be able to ask many questions. But the lawyer was very friendly, like, just understanding the background and taking time to listen and making the eye contact and just simple things, just smiling. Yeah, and just like with a follow-up, with the email, with a plain English, not much with the legal, complex legal terms.
Were you able to get family reunion? Have other members of your family come out to Australia since?
Yes, we've been all reunited in 2016, and my brothers joined us, and now we're all here together. Yeah,
terrific. What about driving offences? You know, when you come to a new country, the rules are very different. Lynn, what are some of the issues around that?
People come from different countries and they have different ways to drive in those countries. We have a very restrictive way of, you know, we regulate our driving in a way that other places in the world just don't regulate their driving. For instance, most people don't either have or use seatbelts in their country of origin. It's something that's very foreign to them. And of course, that's something that we're very keen on people adhering to. So many of the driving offences relate to things like not wearing your seatbelt, speeding, and also, unfortunately, driving without a license. Because again, in some of the places that our clients come from, one just gets in a car, you learn to drive, you can drive, off you go. Now, when people arrive, they're given the information about driving, but it sort of go back to my earlier point that there is such an abundance of information. It's absolute information overload for people when they first arrive. And we recognise that. And so we used to go out to settlement services and talk about things like driving. Between 1 and 3 months after arrival, people simply weren't absorbing that. There was too much. And so we see a lot of generally young men, I have to say, who get into trouble with driving offences of one type or another.
I'm wondering too, Lynn Payne, I understand guardianship matters form a large part of your work. What form do they take?
Many of our families, sort of a significant proportion of them will come. Many of them are very large families, lots of children, and some of those children, it's generally children, have fairly complex health needs. They have almost always been cared for within the family in their country of origin, and decisions are made by usually their parents about where the children go to school and what health services they access and whether or not they should get a passport. And again, it goes back to a lack of regulation in many of the countries that our clients come from. Whereas in Australia, of course, if you want to make a decision on behalf of somebody else, and so we're talking about sort of children, but adult children who have complex health needs, generally sort of mental health conditions, then you have to have a guardianship order. Now, this is, of course, incredibly foreign to our clients. They just, of course, they go to, let's say, the NDIS and they say, well, we want to access this service for our adult child who has some complex needs. And they'll be asked, well, what's your authority for that? And of course, their response to that is, well, I'm his mum or I'm his dad. Well, that's not good enough here. So you'll need a guardianship order. Or you might want to, for example, apply for citizenship for that child who doesn't have the capacity to make those decisions him or herself. The Department of Home Affairs will require guardianship in order for you to make an application for citizenship for your child. So there are lots of agencies, Centrelink is one of them, who don't require that kind of formal level of authority, but many of them do.
Damien Carrick with you. This is The Law Report. Do follow the podcast on the ABC Listen app. Today, we're talking about a children's book designed to help vulnerable women in refugee communities access legal assistance. I'm speaking with Lynn Payne, Senior Solicitor, and Nahara Odishu, Community Engagement Officer, both with the New South Wales Legal Aid Refugee Service, which commissioned The Ribbon.
When grown-ups speak in funny growls and grunts, my ribbon ties into tiny knot. عندما الكبار يتكلمون بشكل مضحك مع الهدير والهمهمات, الشريط يشكل عقدة صغيرة. Not all the knots are tiny. Some of them are huge, and even moms and dads don't know what to do. ليست كل عقد صغيرة وبعضها كبيرة. حتى الأمهات والأباء لا يعرفون ماذا يفعلون. I see the ribbons tangle when white letters make mountains in our home. أرى شرائطهم متشابكة عندما الرسائل البيضاء تتكوم وتشكل جبال في منزلنا.
Lynn Payne, so sometimes you'll act for a woman who might have concerns about their safety and maybe has an apprehended violence order, an AVO, but sometimes the organisation separately, never the same lawyer or never even the same office, will act for a spouse against whom there are allegations of violence or concerns of violence. What are the legal issues for that person? Because if you're not a citizen, right, and you commit a serious offence, criminal offence, which you must be held accountable for, no question, there can be issues around your visa, right?
That's right, yeah. So if a person's convicted, and so we're not just talking about being the subject matter of an AVO, it has to be, you know, to be convicted of a criminal offence that might be somehow connected to the AVO, and it might be, for instance, a breach and any other related violent offences, then if those offences trigger a particular provision of the Migration Act, then your visa must be automatically cancelled.
It's a 12-month 12-month prison sentence threshold. After that, you come out of prison, your visa is cancelled and you're put immediately in immigration detention.
Yes, generally, in fact, you would be transferred immediately from jail to Villawood. Well, in Sydney, it's Villawood, but any detention centre. So you usually would have had, at the end of your sentence, you would know what the status of your visa is. And if it's been cancelled while you're in custody, then you have no visa and the Migration Act says you must be detained. So you'll be transferred from custody to detention centre, the closest detention centre.
And of course, there is no country to send you back to because you're a refugee from that country.
That's right. So Australia's recognised that we have protection obligations towards you, so we can't send you back to your country of origin, despite the fact that we've cancelled your visa on character grounds. So we must, under the Act, you must be detained. And sometimes that can mean, the state of the law at the moment means that you will be detained indefinitely if your visa is not reinstated and if there is no country to return you to, or a third country who might take you.
So how many of your clients are in that boat?
Oh, look, it comes and goes, of course. I mean, we have a number of clients at the moment at various stages, at the departmental stage. So we've made submissions. We're awaiting a decision on whether or not the cancellation will be revoked. We've got other clients who are at the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, so they're on appeal to the department, and yet other clients who are in the courts. So we've judicially reviewed a matter at the AAT. So we've got a number of clients at different stages of that process. All of them, of course, are in detention at the moment because none of them have visas.
Okay, and there are people who have been in detention, immigration detention, for many, many years, aren't there?
Many, many years, yes.
How many years?
Our clients, the ones that I'm thinking of at the moment, haven't been in detention, I say not for very long, but it's all relative, isn't it? I suppose some of them maybe 2 or 3 years. Our service only started in 2017, so we don't have any of the long-termers, but you would know that there have been people in detention for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years who are in the same situation as our clients. They're not our clients, though. We're not acting for them, but certainly there are many long-termers in detention who have been subject to that process.
And what percentage of people on a humanitarian visa, refugees, who serve 12 months prison and are sent to immigration detention, what percentage of those ultimately have their visa reinstated?
Oh, look, that's almost impossible to say, actually, Damien. And it depends sometimes where the person is from. So one of the considerations that the department and the AAT can take into account is, well, what is the risk to the person if they're returned? What are the impediments to their return to their country? So that is a big major factor. And of course, if a person's been out of a country for, say, 10 years, and you might consider that there is less risk to them if they returned. If a person's been outside of their country for 1 year and then they've come to Australia and they've had unfortunately been engaged in a visa cancellation process, you might say, well, the risk of persecution is still very much alive and very real. And so in that case, you'd be arguing fairly strenuously that the impediments to their return are a real risk of persecution. So that would be given more weight by the department. So it's impossible to say who might get their visa back and who might. It's entirely factual.
Mm. Nahara Adishu, are these sort of questions and are these issues, do people come and talk to you about them? I mean, do people understand what the issues are when it comes to cancellation of visas?
Not really, they don't. And even the division between like civil and crime, it's all different for our clients. I think for our clients, as Lynn mentioned before, we were not there like tell them to lecture them about the law. It's more like you have trouble. You receive this letter from immigration, from Centrelink. You just need to come and speak with a lawyer. Don't ignore the letter. Just don't put it on the side and don't look at it. And the problem will disappear. You need to act quickly and as early as possible. And this is through talking to the community or to the settlement services, community services that work with the clients, and they have that relationship with the clients to do those referrals as soon as possible.
So it's about helping clients understand that, you know, you can go get help. Don't sit on problems as they mount up. Don't start worrying about them. Don't let the ribbon tighten into a knot.
Exactly, yeah.
Access the help that is out there. I'm wondering, Nahara Adishu, can you tell me about a few of the clients that you've helped?
We have assisted countless numbers of clients with applications to reunite with their families overseas. One case concerned about a family, again from persecuted minority in Iraq, who had fled Iraq to Turkey with their three very young sons. The eldest son, who was 10 at that time, was separated from their family and ended up in Germany as a refugee, living with their relatives, which the rest of the family came to Australia, settled in Wagga Wagga. Well, we started assisting the family in June 2018 to get their now 12 years old son to Australia to reunite with their family. And that happened in March in 2020. His visa was granted, but then COVID happened and the borders were closed with no one was permitted to enter except the most exceptional of cases. We lobbied and advocate for this young man, now 14, to be allowed to join his family. And in September of 2020, he has arrived during the border closure.
And look, if they hadn't got help and they really wouldn't have known where to go if they didn't. That's a lovely story. Any other stories very quickly?
We had the client when the service started. A client came with her daughter and she was asking that she wanna end the lease that she had with her husband at that time, and just going through the lease, why she wanted to end the lease, because she wanted to leave her husband. There was severe DV towards the wife, our clients, and her daughter. Based on those domestic violence issues, we were able to end the lease for the clients because she was her name was on the lease. She was part of the, so that was successful without her paying any extra amount, without any break fees. And then I assessed the clients to apply for public housing, and considering she's in the priority list, considering she's newly arrived refugee, it's only her and her daughter with no support. And then the way that she came to us was just about lease, about tenancy issues. She wasn't acknowledging the DV that was a part of the problem. But when we ask questions, what to communicate with the real estate agent and the landlord, that came up. Oh, that is a DV. I need to leave. I'm not feeling safe. Yeah.
So you're able to get to those deeper issues by starting off with a more general conversation.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's why our clients, they don't know. They can't identify this is domestic violence, this is happening with their family, but just through other legal issues that they need help with, whether it's tenancy or parenting or divorce. Yeah.
So it speaks to the importance of having relationships, trusting relationships with the service out there.
Yeah, exactly. And access to legal services through, say, now the book, and not just a traditional way of flyers and brochures.
Nahara Adishu and Lynn Payne, both from the New South Wales Legal Aid Refugee Service, which commissioned the ribbon. Good talking to you. And congratulations on the new book. It's a lovely read.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And The Ribbon is written by Monica Elia and illustrated by Hussein Nabil, who both arrived in Australia as refugees. That's the Law Report for this week. Do follow the podcast on the ABC Listen app. A big thank you to producer Christina Kukolia and to technical producer this week, Brendan O'Neill. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more Law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.